People once believed that when someone dies, a crow carries their soul to the land of the dead. But sometimes, something so bad happens that a terrible sadness is carried with it, and the soul can't rest. Then sometimes, just sometimes, the crow can bring that soul back to put the wrong things right.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's The Crow Retrospective Series.
You have no idea what hell awaits you.
Hosted by Stuart.
All must love you.
Arnie.
I feel that you are quite brilliant and broken.
And Jacob.
Didn't we kill that guy?
This episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and strong language.
Word of the wise, watch your fucking mouth.
We hope you enjoy the show.
It can't rain all the time.
Today we're discussing The Crow, Wicked Prayer, starring what the producer calls the best cast of any Crow movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that includes Edward Furlong, Tara Reid, David Boreanaz, Emmanuel Shrieky, and Dennis Hopper with Danny Trejo and Macy Gray.
That blew my mind.
Yeah. He's not wrong.
Directed by Lance Minghia. What's up, Bones? This is Mac Daddy Arnie calling you up, man. And that's about how Dennis Hopper delivered that line.
And Stuart.
And it's Jacob. Get it right, Cracker Jack.
Okay, I asked last time. I'm going to ask each time. Why do another Crow film?
I do need to know.
You failed at the TV show. You failed at the books. You got nothing. The direct-to-tape. Did that rent well? Salvation?
Actually, according to what I read on Wikipedia, Salvation sold very well when it was released on DVD.
Okay, then you make another one straight to tape 5 years later.
Now, this wasn't going to be the movie they were supposed to make. There had been discussions where they were going to make a Crow film called The Crow, Lazarus, which was going to be an undead rapper played by DMX facing off against an evil undead record producer, possibly played by Eminem in his first feature film role.
Oh, come on now.
That's so 2005.
Yeah, that was pipe dream. I could believe they could get DMX. Eminem after 8 Mile, give me a break.
No, this would be before 8 Mile.
Okay.
But either way, the rapper was going to be killed in a drive-by and then brought back to life.
Of course.
There's some stereotypical storytelling for you that we're not going to be talking about with Wicked Prayer.
I've never seen DMX in a movie. I barely know his music. You know, I'm glad I don't have to watch that. I'll say that.
So instead, they went for inspiration to that book series you mentioned last podcast, Stuart. Book 5 of 6 in that series is called The Crow, Wicked Prayer. I read that book. This movie is loosely based on that book.
Like the last one.
That really wasn't based on it. But this, when you watch the credits, they do cite, in talking about the screenplay and where it came from, they cite a book. So what happened in the book, Arnie?
A man goes to propose to his half Native American girlfriend.
Is that why she has blue eyes? She's only half?
Yes. But two goths are into black magic. And they were there because they needed a Native American with blue eyes for their ritual to get magical evil powers. And these two know about the crow and don't even want to kill anyone because they know that the spirits of the crow will bring back whoever they kill to try and stop them. But they screw up and kill this guy, Dan Cody. And so he comes back to life and chases them through the desert while they rush off to Vegas to get married and perform their evil rituals. But it's led by the woman in that book as compared to here, where it's run by David Boreanaz. And it's not a very good book because we focus more on the bad guys than on Dan Cody. Dan Cody just has a lot of angst and argues with the bird in the desert for half the book.
Sounds great.
He's just really pissed off at this bird and pissed off that his fiance is dead and that he has to go through all this. But finally, we get to a climax, and much like the last book, like you said, Stuart, wasn't very good because the crow only had one person to kill. Here, there's only two people involved in his fiancée's murder, so it's a pretty bloodless crow movie. The bad guys kill again and again, but our crow doesn't have a whole lot to do. It was not a very good book.
It sounds like they were even bored with the central character, that they were more interested in following the Satanist to Vegas than doing the same thing again, because that is boring.
Yes.
That is very, very boring. And I am not excited as I sit down to watch this fourth incarnation of something I never liked. But it is being done by different people, and it's worth pointing out. You say, great cast. It's a cast I know, top to bottom. Almost everyone that pops up here, I have seen before. Furlong, I mean, it's been 13 years or so since T2.
Yeah, the last thing I would have seen him in when this movie came out was Detroit Rock City, which came out in 99.
That was 99? Wow. I thought it was close to this, but
I don't know if that was true right now, but struggle with substances and just, you know, when you're not a child star anymore, everyone puts it on you when you're a child star, and when you grow up and you're not as cute, your life's awful, right? Like, he had that story by this point. Strange that he would be the crow. I would almost put it on him to be, you know, Pestilence or something like that. He doesn't feel like leading man material.
Not as a, imposing superhero that's going to get vengeance. That's not who I imagine.
But Boreanaz, he was a much bigger star, but was known for playing anti-hero. See, to me, he would be your perfect crow. I don't know why they relegate him to the villain role.
You know, this is almost stereotyping his acting, because in Buffy, he was a good vampire who then turned evil. And he had played multiple personalities of that character, Angel, in various types. So when I see him here playing a bad guy, it's reminding me a lot of his performance as evil Angel. And this was filmed in 2003. Angel would end shortly after. It would end in 2004. So he was at kind of a low point in his career before he'd pick up Bones, which I can't believe ran for 12 years, but it did.
Yeah, that guy's never not been on TV, it feels like, but this is catching him before he booked another gig. And so he was willing to do straight to tape part fours of Crows. Tara Reid, she's totally up for it. I mean,
when I saw Tara Reid, that was the 1-2 punch, her and Eddie Furlong. I'm like, oh, this is going to be crap if Tara Reid's in it with him.
Same year as Uwe Boll's Alone in the Dark for her.
Oh.
She was not invited to the third American Pie movie, so I don't know if she thought she was too good for it or they just didn't need her.
I think she ended up in Sharknado, right?
Yeah, she had also kind of some substance use, walking the red carpet and being made fun of. I just remember she was a target for whatever reason for being a party girl out of control in that era where we cared so much about them.
But she would return to American Pie. She'll be happy to return to American Pie in 2012 for American Reunion. That's a step up.
She went to the reunion.
Yeah, this is the beginning of a very dark phase, I think, for her. And yeah, don't tell me anyone was saying it's going to theaters. They knew, right? They knew that this was only going to be hitting Blockbuster.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This was made as a direct-to-DVD feature, but a tortured process, as I understand it. They started doing this film with scripts and treatments in 2001, filmed it in 2003, released it in 2005. The director sounds so exhausted on the two commentaries. Yes, they did two fucking commentaries for this movie.
He has a lot to say.
And he just sounds so exhausted and ready to move on to another project that I don't think ever came.
Yeah, I was shocked when I looked up this director because I'm like, I'm not going to know who this is. And I had seen, I think he has one cult film.
Yes.
Other than this, called Six String Samurai, which I saw a very long time ago, like back in the day when Netflix was only discs. And yeah, probably the mid-2000s, probably around the time this came out. But I heard that there's this, it sounded like an Alex Cox film, if you know Repo Man, this satirical post-apocalypse with this Buddy Holly looking guitar player that's also a samurai, and like great setup, and I just remember it being super boring and not living up to the satirical and comedic promise that I thought it had.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but it definitely was hyped. It was at the end of the 90s when, you know, the indie market was starting, the bottom was starting to fall out on it. But they were hyping him as the next Robert Rodriguez. They made it look like it was an El Mariachi sequel. And it just looked like there was kung fu that was all trickery, like through sped up imagery, and nobody really had any fight skills. And maybe that's part of the comedy, that it was like half Napoleon Dynamite, half El Mariachi. But I never got a chance to see it. I tried to hunt it down to watch in parallel with this and could not find it.
Like I said, I had to get it on a disc in the 2000s from Netflix.
It seems to be gone, but I guess that's why they bring him here. It certainly explains why this crow looks and feels so different. It definitely has much more of a spaghetti western vibe. The goth industrial crowiness has been forgotten. The musical choices couldn't be less hip.
That's because they couldn't afford the music the director wanted to put in it. They couldn't get a single needle drop.
What did he want? What Rob Zombie song did he want?
He was specific on one of the commentaries. I didn't write down what song he had been playing in the background of a scene that he was hoping that they could put in there. But no, this thing was done on the cheap. I think all the money went to the cast. I mean, we got Dennis Hopper in here.
Yep.
Didn't they just offer him cocaine? I feel like, here's some drugs. Come let us film you for a day.
You know, same year as Romero's Land of the Dead, he was not getting the great work that he had decades before. He was just sort of trading parts with Malcolm McDowell.
But at least Land of the Dead went to theaters.
Yeah, I get it. And it's nice to be able to have a cast that we know. I'm emboldened that it's not going to look and feel. Quite frankly, I'm tired of Rob Zombie and Hole and trying to go for a look that in 2005 wouldn't even be playing to the kids. You know, you say DMX and Eminem, at least that would have been staying with current times. They're going against trends. You tell me it's for money, I'm encouraged that it is a new direction for whatever reason. We're going to get something different this time, for sure.
Yeah, that was part of what brought the director on. He was actually trying to get a different film. I believe he said it was a Western he was trying to get made. And the producer said, what about a new Crow film? And he's like, only if we can do something different. Only if we're not going to replay the same beats we've done in three other Crow films.
Someone broke a promise.
Well, I know what he means, and yes, it still is a Crow film. Let's talk about it. Arnie, give him that familiar plot. We'll see how much this wicked prayer answers our prayers.
Edward Furlong is Jimmy Cuervo, an ex-con who went away for killing a rapist. Now free, he's almost universally hated by the members of his town. Only one person believes in him, Jimmy's girlfriend Lily. Despite objections by Lily's father, played by Danny Trejo, and Lily's brother, Jimmy is about to propose to Lily. Unfortunately, that's the day David Boreanaz's character, Luke Crash, breaks out of prison, aided by his girlfriend, Lola Byrne, played by Tara Reid. Yes, this movie will crash and burn. Lola has a Satanist spellbook that will enable Luke to become Satan, but to do this, Lola must steal Lily's blue eyes. Aided by goons, war, pestilence, and famine, named after the four horsemen of the apocalypse, with Luke himself being death, Luke and Lola take Lily hostage. When Jimmy walks in on their crime, they tie Jimmy up as well. Lola cuts out Lily's eyes, and Luke cuts out Jimmy's heart. The two lovers are hanged and killed. A crow then comes and brings Jimmy back to life. He's out to take revenge on Luke and his gang. One by one, he kills Luke's horsemen, but war wounds Jimmy's crow, making Jimmy vulnerable. Meanwhile, Luke has grown stronger. Luke and Lola make it to a church that's also a brothel run by El Nino, played by Dennis Hopper. El Nino begins to perform the marriage of Lola and Luke, which will turn Luke into Satan. Now when Jimmy fights Luke, Luke is strong enough to defeat Jimmy. Luke crucifies Jimmy above the altar at the whorehouse, and then the newly married Luke and Lola go off to have sex, which will impregnate Lola with the Antichrist. The townspeople come upon the strung-up Jimmy. Lily's father has come to believe Jimmy can avenge his daughter, so he has Jimmy cut down. Jimmy goes after Luke while Lily's father does a ritual to heal Jimmy's crow. The crow is restored to full health, and Jimmy is able to catch up to Luke and easily defeat him in hand-to-hand combat. Jimmy kills Luke, but leaves Lola to be arrested by the police. And Jimmy goes to be with Lily in the afterlife as credits roll.
As we start, we have a town divided, quite literally, on one half of this city out in the remote desert. Feels very spaghetti western. We have the Raven Aztec Reservation, and they want to have a Native American casino, and that's going to put all the workers, the miners, at Lake Ravasu. They're really good at disguising these crow names.
I hate it so much.
Yeah.
You know, Cuervo, Jimmy's name, is Spanish for crow.
Yeah, well, I don't love the names.
I gotta ask, is this taking place in South America? Aztecs are not a tribe in North America, are they? Like, I get so confused in this film throughout.
I was thinking, why did they cast all these Hispanics as Native Americans?
Yes.
Apparently, according to the commentary, one of the commentaries, there really was a tribe of Mexicans that had lived in New Mexico and were Native Americans.
But Aztecs?
Well, he wanted Hispanic Native Americans instead of stereotypical Native Americans. So we get this very confusing Aztec tribe instead of Killers of the Flower Moon.
Well, here's what I would say. I asked in the first show, whoever heard of a crow taking any souls to the afterlife? At least we now finally have met the tribe. They're made up. They're fictional. They're not Aztecs, Jacob. They're Raven Aztecs.
That's even more confusing.
I mean, it's not confusing when you consider that this movie is going to be a goofy comedy. I guess I'll use that word, or at least something that feels less dour and self-serious than anything we've gotten before.
I just don't know what the purpose of this setup is. There's a mine, there's a casino they want built. None of this stuff's gonna matter. We're not gonna have a big action scene climax in the mine. We're not gonna see a casino blown up. I feel like there's a lot here to set up a prison escape when you could have just cut to Lola freeing Luke.
Well, Arnie has mentioned that there was a lot of rewriting, and I suspect the inspiration had to be spaghetti westerns. Again, if you think about Fistful of Dollars and the way that half the town was one gang and that the other gang owned the other half, that you have white miners and then Native Americans on the other side and lovers that are also matching that divide. I don't think that's a bad instinct. I actually kind of like that as putting a story. I don't want another dank, dark, noir, dark city. That I do not want.
That's fine, but that never plays out, though. It obviously got dropped.
Yes, I do feel like, yes, the threads, as many of them do, gets lost. What I'm trying to understand as we get this opening is they want to start it with some spectacular action, and we have four guys who have been negatively impacted by the mines. Pestilence is dying of cancer because of the mining, I think.
Yeah, we're going to get a speech from Danny Trejo later that what happened was under their lake was copper, and the government wanted the copper, so they agreed to drain the lake and let the government dig in the copper, which they said was going to be a clean operation. But we're going to find out that Pestilence here, his job was toxic waste removal, and the government's mining has polluted this town. And so by removing this toxic waste, Pestilence has terminal cancer.
And he was only offered apologies because we're going to get this crazy like descriptors for the, I guess, three horsemen popping up, telling us their motivations, what their jobs are. I was just excited to see Chosen from The Karate Kid 2 popping up here as Pestilence.
Yes, and he's back as Chosen in Cobra Kai.
I was so excited when he came back in Cobra Kai.
Of course, I know him from Real Genius.
Of course you do. You know, I hear your complaint, but I actually kind of like this. I kind of like the fact that we have this guy War, and it's mentioned that he had three brothers that died because of all this. They all have personal reasons to being against this mine operation, for seeing it destroyed. And I kind of like the splashiness. It feels very, like I said, a cross between Napoleon Dynamite and From Dusk Till Dawn. It's got some Robert Rodriguez to it.
And I think there is something with The Crow where I don't mind when it goes kind of big and broad with its metaphors. Like, you're going to do the Four Horsemen. It makes sense for this franchise. I will buy that. But again, my confusion is there's so much setup about this mine. I thought this movie was going to be about this mine. They're blowing it up. This is all just to create a cover for Luke to get freed later on. This mine does not matter.
No, it doesn't, and it's very frustrating. And they even cut some scenes about the mine, but those deleted scenes on the disc don't provide any clarity. They're just literally more talking about this mine and this casino. And it's really frustrating that there's not more focus to this. None of this matters. When we're starting the film, what really matters is the breakout of David Boreanaz's death, or Luke. You know, it is spelled L-U-C, short for Lucifer, of course.
But that's the weird thing. I think that they're flashing devil horns and creating all this anarchy, firing shotguns, spewing gasoline over everything. I think Famine is intentionally feeding poison from his food truck.
I thought they just had, like, stomach cancer from the radiation or whatever in the mine. I had no idea what was going on there.
No, they're definitely acting out and hurting all the white people that are there. I thought the Four Horsemen were metaphorical. It is a real surprise to me when I realize, and it's late in the film, when I actually realize, oh, wait, they actually do want to raise the devil?
Yeah, this is about bringing Satan back, and that gets lost somehow in this plot.
Yeah, I wasn't prepared, because I really was invested in the whole mind thing, and it is a real switcheroo when we're talking about birthing the Antichrist, and yeah, that Boreanaz is actually a Satanist. We have this moment where he's freed from the chain gang, and he looks at a church and thinks about setting a priest on fire. He means that. I don't know why he's a Satanist, but he really does want the church to burn.
I mean, it says his mission is to raise hell, literally.
Mm-hmm. I thought, and I don't know if it was in the book or if you can speak to it, Arnie, through all the commentary and stuff, he kind of looks like Edward Furlong. I thought they were brothers. I assumed when we jump cut to Edward Furlong in his trailer and we have these sepia-toned flashbacks of them together, that they were actually brothers, that they knew each other and had broken apart because they both went after the same girl, and of course Edward Furlong would get her.
They talk about going after the same girl. None of this is from the book.
Okay.
So we can basically throw the book away. I told you the parallels. It's that there was a white guy who had a Native American girlfriend. Her eyes get cut out, and then he's chasing mystics through the desert. But what we're supposed to get here is just Luke and Jimmy served prison time together. They were buddies in prison.
Oh.
Yeah.
We get a flashback of that.
We do? They were in a chain gang? I thought they were just on a migrant truck.
No, they were in a chain gang together while Jimmy was in prison for murder.
Okay. Because, yeah, the sepia-toned scene is of them looking at the same girl and saying, man, she's hot, while she's attending the funeral of her rapist that Edward Furlong killed?
You know, Edward Furlong killing that rapist is really underdeveloped.
Okay.
We're going to get a flashback of him attacking a guy who looks like it's attacking a woman. Is that woman Lily? I didn't think so.
I thought so.
Oh, I assumed it was.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know, but he apparently kills this guy. You know, there's a newspaper article that comes up on the screen. I didn't freeze frame it to read all the details there, but that may be what you have to do if you really want the backstory of this reason why Jimmy went to jail. Apparently for a very short amount of time, though, because Edward Furlong is just in his 20s. If he committed murder and his parole is almost up, he's about to be completely free. He's like, my parole ends at midnight. He didn't serve a whole lot of time for killing this rapist.
Yeah, and I can believe that. Again, that's what you sense is the privilege of this white guy that he's already out here. That's part of why the reservation is grumbling, and we see someone spray painting killer on his trailer.
Specifically, Indian killer.
Oh, okay.
They use a pejorative term, but yes.
Yeah, I try not to use that word, but if that's what they said, I guess we can say it.
I mean, it was in print on the house or on the trailer.
Okay, I only saw killer part, but yes, the point is he's stuck there serving out the rest of his parole, and at midnight, he'll be able to leave behind this world that hates him, and I don't think the minor world likes him any better than the Indian reservation, but he is in love with Lily, who seems to be some kind of religious shaman leader of the Aztec Raven tribe.
Where they just have blue eyes.
But she doesn't have blue eyes. It kills me.
No, it's so confusing.
They say she has blue eyes, her lovely blue eyes. They have to kill her for her blue eyes. Her eyes are clearly brown.
And clearly she doesn't have good vision because she's with Edward Furlong.
Now, I don't know about you guys, but I had a real problem with Edward Furlong's performance. In his enunciation and his endless whispering, it wasn't very long into this movie. It was the scene of Jimmy and Lily together and her saying she believes in him and he has to let all his anger go that I'm like, I need subtitles to understand what Edward Furlong is saying in this movie.
I always have subtitles running. So yes, I was reading a lot. And yes, sometimes I don't feel like the sound mix in this was particularly good. I was relying on knowing what was going on by reading.
Yeah, he's trying to do a lot of brooding because it's a Crow film.
But it's not. And again, one thing I want to compliment, and it's a genuine compliment, is this thing is just way too goofy. He wakes up with a scorpion on him and puts it in a bag of scorpions he has in his fridge. And it takes a while to find out that he brings it to the trading post where they make, what is that, paperweights or something out of it.
Yeah, they put him in resin. Yeah.
There's a quirkiness to this. I go to Napoleon Dynamite, but there's just a lot of films around at this time. This sort of indie, sarcastic, comedic vibe that, okay, this director is not great at, but at least it feels more appealing to me than the noir nightmare landscape.
See, and to me, it's just confusing because I'm like, scorpions, okay, that's going to come into the mythos. We're going to have a crow versus a scorpion, and we see Lily holding one of those resin scorpions. Like, I think mines, casinos, scorpions, I'm putting all the pieces, and then they just go away. I find this movie so confusing.
I understand that, Jacob, and the only reason I wasn't confused by the scorpions is in the book, he makes a living by selling scorpions to this trading post.
He could make a living doing that?
Well, he also was selling them to a college professor, but that's a subplot that didn't make it into the movie.
Okay.
But, Stuart, are you finding this funny? Because it's blowing my mind that you're saying this is intentional comedy, because I don't find any of this funny. I didn't even think they were trying for funny. This is like a totally new perspective on this movie that on three watchings, two with commentaries and one with dialogue and subtitles, I never thought they were going for funny.
And I think viewers, listeners, long time know that sometimes what I read is funny, you don't see as funny. We have many shows where we debate whether something is intentional comedy or not. To me, this director is a sarcastic 90s indie auteur who is trying to mimic a Robert Rodriguez-style spaghetti western. And yes, you have to admit, it at least feels goofier than anything. All the other Crow movies never crack a smile. Well, I guess Brandon Lee sometimes made jokes.
And so did Alex in the last one.
Yeah, Salvation had jokes.
Largely humorless. The movies themselves were dour and filled with violence and rage, and you were supposed to rage out too. And this one, because we don't have that soundtrack, I'm surprised when they actually have gothic makeup, because I'm like, this don't feel goth to me. This feels, yeah, like a quirky spaghetti western comedy. Beetlejuice.
I'll say this, Stuart. I get humor whenever we're not focusing on Edward Furlong, when we're focusing on the satanic group. Like, yeah, I do think there's comedy there. For sure.
Yeah, how could you not see them as cartoonish?
David Boreanaz often plays comedic villainy. So I do see some intentional humor in his performance. He's playing it very broad, too broad for my tastes, honestly. But outside of that, I am taking this with the same tone that I have taken three other Crow films, two Crow books, and a Crow comic book, all with the same nihilistic revenge story.
Yeah, I think Jimmy is just as dour as all the other Crows we've talked about.
Again, I get a Tim Burton-ish. There's just, it's the world around him. He may be playing the same misunderstood goth who's so in love with the woman, but it doesn't have the conviction that the earlier movies did. It doesn't ask us to believe in the injustice and their romance with the intensity, the humorlessness of the convictions in the original trilogy. And that to me is a directing tone. That is an approach you can see in almost every scene. But yes, definitely when you look at the villains, it's quite obvious that they're going for funny.
Are they going for funny when we see Jimmy's car and it looks like a beaten up hatchback, but it's painted like the General Lee? It's got the 01 on the doors. It's orange. There's a Confederate flag on top. I don't know that you could get away with a Confederate flag if living on a Native American reservation.
He's not popular, so I mean, might as well, you know? But yeah, I mean, there's a reason why he wants to leave here. He is not accepted here. The real question to ask is, why is Lily into him? She's very beautiful. She's very popular. She's the religious leader of the community. Why would she run away with him and leave all of this behind when they're just breaking ground on a new casino that she's sanctioning here in the opening?
Yeah, once again, a Crow film, which is based on this giant, undying love between a man and a woman. Very bad love story. Like, I don't get the relationship. Probably least of all in this one.
No, I would actually argue it's the one that spends the most time setting it up. In each previous Crow, I mean, the second one was a father and son's love, but
yeah,
we never really understood until the middle of the movie why they were attacked, what they were going after, who they were as people before they were victims. They always sold them as victims first. And here we have a good 20 minutes before they're attacked by our evil gang.
Yeah, we see one more scene of Jimmy being harassed by the cop, Lily's brother, who's a deputy on the reservation. But yes, he crosses the street, he's off the reservation, and going to propose to Lily. But of course, Luke and his gang are there, she's tied up, and they need her eyes for their evil magic.
And they needed eyes in the first one. That is a carryover, but I just thought that they were being wicked. You know, I just assumed that they were like bad people. Like, it really is a surprise to me. This is, I guess, where I realize Tara Reid goes at her with this ceremonial dagger off screen for the most part. We don't see the violence, but when she absorbs the eyes into her palms and suddenly claims she can see the future, I go, wait a minute. This is not just, you know, hoodlums. These are actual occultists.
And before the eyes are cut out, you talked about Luke and Jimmy both wanting the same girl. Tara Reid gets kind of pissed off because Luke goes up to Lily and is like, I could never have a woman like you. And Lola gets kind of pissed about that. I think Lola wants Lily's eyes because she wants to be more like Lily for Luke.
Sure, that tracks. Yeah, no one wants Tara Reid.
I'll go with that. I don't really understand anyone's motivations. Like, they want to be satanic because, I don't know, you get cool powers, but it's the right way to go, especially in a Crow film. Like, I want to see the Crow take on something else that's supernatural. It only seems fair if he gets supernatural powers. I want to see him take on something big, not just like slumlords or whatever we've been getting.
Agreed. It's an unfair fight to see supernatural messiah that can never die except when he gets gaslit, fighting some grimy people that don't have a prayer of matching his physical prowess. So yes, they fixed it. If anything, it seems like Edward Furlong is hopelessly outmatched, even though we know he's coming back with Crow power. David Boreanaz is going to be Satan himself. I mean, I don't know how you one-up that.
He's also going to be Mola Ram because he's going to cut out Jimmy's heart. And we're still going to get a sound effect of that heart beating.
Why does he need Jimmy's heart? I get why she wants the eyes to see the future. But this heart is suddenly, like, I see that writing 666 is appearing on his chest. And more of his torso is going to be covered in devil script.
I thought he just was getting 666s all over him.
Yeah, it looks like scars. I noticed it was on his chest before he cuts out the heart.
It was?
You can see it under the shirt. I think it's kind of a film flub, but it's, I think, supposed to appear.
Okay, you weren't supposed to notice it.
But is there something about Jimmy in his heart? Is he a good person? Is he a vessel of God, as he'll be later described?
Yeah, this is going to be about the Crows, like Christian, like God. I guess it doesn't have to be a Christian God, but God is sending the Crows down as angels to do his work.
Well, it is the Aztec Raven, so I assume that he is the spiritual leader. By being with Lily and getting the power that he does, I don't think he would get the Crow power had he not be connected to the shaman woman. I think that's part of it.
Except we've seen three other Crows who weren't connected to shaman. So I just took this as it was another undying love. And the pain was so great that Jimmy was brought back, chosen by a Crow. Whether it was due to the Native American connection or just in this world. I mean, they talked about it in the last film briefly. Alex in that film was like, maybe I was sent back by a benevolent God. But I have reason to believe lately that maybe there is no benevolent God. nod. So we have a lot of theories about what may be sending back the Krows. You have to believe there is an afterlife in the Krow universe. That's the whole thing, is to be together in the afterlife. You have to avenge what happened in this life. So
yeah, and again, the idea of purity, they just downplay that a little. He has the power of her people, but ironically, her people don't recognize that for much of the movie. But laughs, I mean, I'm actually laughing out loud. I will just say, when they go to get rid of the bodies and Famine recognizes the freezer that his mom used to lock him up in, I laughed. I thought that was funny that they put the bodies.
I grimaced. I did not like it.
Yeah, I actually cringed.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, were you rolling when they were eating like deviled eggs and devil-themed food for their ritual? I just thought it was stupid.
Yeah, how can you not recognize that as comedy? Maybe you say it's stupid. It is stupid. I want to be clear. Humor is stupid many times. But like, it isn't to be mocked for being passed off as like the other movies. This is a tongue-in-cheek.
See, what pissed me off about the deviled eggs and the devil's food cake and all of that is that if I'm supposed to believe these are real Satanists and he's really going to become Satan, then I have to buy some seriousness from them and not think that they are wannabe posers eating deviled eggs with peyote.
Why? I'm confused. Why can't they be wannabes?
Because they're really going to do it.
Because they're really absorbing eyes and hearts and have that real magic. Yeah, if you want me to be scared that the devil has been reincarnated, having this guy eat devil's food cake is not doing it.
They don't. I think you think that this movie is following the pattern of the last three. They are not trying to scare you. They are not trying to create menace. Goofy, funny, nutso, gonzo. That is what I'm getting off of this. It is not to be taken with any seriousness. Occultists can be buffoons, and these ones clearly are when they start tripping out and doing what they're doing in these scenes. Again, the relief I'm having is that I'm not being asked to take their villainy so seriously.
See, and I am taking it serious. I'm seeing it as serious, which is why when they're eating devil's food cake, I feel like it's undercutting the villainy. You mentioned it's nice that they fixed it and they're giving the Krow an adversary that is worthy of a Krow, somebody who a Krow would really have to work hard to beat. And then when I see them as wannabes, it really takes away from having a good adversary in this film.
Let's be clear. You have enjoyed what has happened in the past and you want to see them make an even better version. I hated everything they did in the past, and I love the fact that we're doing something else. Is it good? No. Is it stupid? Oh, yes. But it is better, I'll use the word better, than anything we've seen so far.
Oh.
If you're going to say this is the best Krow film, I'm sorry.
It is the best Krow film of the four.
Okay, I'm done then. I'm done. I can't have a conversation with someone that thinks this is the best one. I'm sorry.
And I'm going to back you up, Jacob. This is the worst Krow film by a lot. By a whole lot.
No.
It's bad.
Look, if what you want is the Krow represented by the Obar comic book, I get that this is a total betrayal. It is, you know, mocking, really, everything, the self-seriousness by which he tried to process his grief. But I don't want to process grief the way those movies process grief. I think that those movies are weightless and annoying. And here, again, weightless and annoying still apply, but it just feels more acceptable because it doesn't ask me to believe in it. It's just a goofy thing.
Yeah, this feels like you're praising a scary movie or one of those parody films.
Yeah. I'd rather watch Death Race 2050 than the Jason Statham movie. It's like that.
Okay.
Oh, God, I could never go with that.
I agree. We've had this discussion about humor, and I think there are clear lines here. What I can find amusing, you treat with disgust.
I think you would need a Krow that is on the level as the Satanic group, and Edward Furlong is not someone that could pull that off.
No, there is nothing funny about what Edward Furlong is doing, at least not intentional humor. His resurrection and then his remembering he went to Rave Infest. Get it? Like a rave? Rave Infest?
Yeah, with the other 300 Raven references throughout this film.
and Lily made him wear some makeup, so he's going to put on the makeup like he wore at Ravenfest and go after them. You are getting a Crow performance that could be transplanted into any of the more nihilistic Crow films. He is just doing what has been done.
No. When he's got the hair and the makeup and all that, he looks much goofier. Much goofier.
It is the worst looking Crow.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, of course it is.
And you're saying this is funny. This is intentional. This is meant to be a mockery.
Yes, close to that. Yeah. Mockery, no, but in a different register. It is what would be a good comparison. I'll have to think about it. But I definitely feel like you have a director that is not trying to honor the source material. He is trying to make his own goofy Western like Six String Samurai and doesn't really care about what happened before, taking the archetypes and bending them to his whim.
I don't see this being vastly different from the formulas we've discussed in the last three films.
Because it's a Crow movie, but you can see that it's very different in tone, incredibly different in the way its presentation.
Yes, with the bad guys, I agree. It's funny when it's focusing on evil people.
But even, I mean, this character, again, popping out of a fridge and the way that he looks, and he looks goofy. I mean, this performance could be given by Paul Rubens. It is absurd.
I wish it was.
I do too, and it is absurd, but I put that on the limitations of the actor cast. I don't put this on any intentional direction.
Let me be clear. I don't think this is a good movie. I'm not going to recommend it. I'm just saying that this tone is more acceptable to me than the trash we've gotten for the last three movies.
And I guess my statement is the tone is so wildly uneven that I can't get a fix on it.
I feel like tone has always been a problem in every Crow movie, but there is no point in this story where I am asked to believe in the purity of this love or the horror of what's been done to them. It is goofy from start to finish, full of quirky details that you would find in an indie movie from the 90s.
So is it humor when we're going to get the scene with Luke going to a church and confronting the term they use in the film is Indian because they said his motive was his father was murdered by an Indian. This preacher up there is the Native American who murdered Luke's father, and he's going to get his revenge. This is intentional amusing? I just take this as character motivation.
No, this scene feels like it came from like three different rewrites. It doesn't make any sense to me. I didn't get that. For one thing, I'll just go ahead and say that this was one of the scenes I had trouble understanding what was being said. I thought he was asking the guy for $47.66 that he was owed.
No, the guy killed Luke's dad for the $47.66 that Luke's dad had in a donation box.
Oh, okay. Missed that part of it. Again, so it felt goofy to me that he killed him over chump change, but no, I mean, the scene doesn't need to be here and is only here because it will end up, we will find out that these are the parents of the rapist of Lily that Jimmy went to jail killing.
Yeah, perhaps this is the most respectable actor in the whole film, Rena Owen, who I have her autograph because she was in Attack of the Clones, but in our book, Jacob picked And Once Were Warriors, which has Rena Owen in it in an amazing role.
It was just sad to see like that this is what she has to do. Like, she's so much better than this.
But she's not. Because here she is. That's the gig of acting, is that you can be in greatness and then turn around and not.
When you're a Kiwi, I guess you take what roles you could get.
Yes. Look, I don't have much to say about this whole subplot. It feels needless. It feels like we've gone into a strange side. It neither satisfyingly explains why Jimmy went to jail, nor it makes more intriguing Lucifer's backstory, why he's a Satanist.
Yeah, what the director said he was trying to do here, and I say trying because I don't feel he succeeded.
Yeah, he failed because I have no idea.
Is he wanted a movie world in which no one was all good and no one was all bad. You see, Luke is bad because someone killed his dad. And Jimmy isn't all good because he murdered a person. And so everyone is supposed to be shades of gray in this film.
I mean, if you have a movie about a superhero getting revenge, I don't know, I kind of want it black and white. I want to make sure he's killing the right bad guys. I don't want it gray.
Whatever. Again, like I said, it's a world where everyone looks goofy and there is no obvious representation of, even though later Danny Trejo will marvel at the fact that Edward Furlong is a representation of God. I don't see it that way. I don't see this as the story of pure goodness versus pure evil. And so it makes sense that there are shades of gray because that's the quirkiness of this directorial vision. I do like, once Edward Furlong, we got to have a bunch of killing scenes. That's one thing that will define all Crow movies, is that he comes back to start whacking people. He starts with Pestilence, who's been tasked to get peyote from a bar lit entirely by bug lights.
Bug zappers!
And like earlier, he was eating the scorpions and all. This guy just, I don't know why he likes eating bugs, but it's just one of his quirks, and he will die by bug zap.
I could not believe that. It shows Pestilence. He's sitting there with all these bug zappers. I'm like, and then the Crow shows up. I'm like, he's going to kill him with a bug zapper, isn't he? And again, maybe this is for people like Stuart that hate this franchise. This is uproarious, I guess. I just find this cheap and unsatisfying.
Well, Jacob, that surprises me because I do feel like you like goofiness like this. If I told you I got a movie about a guy that dies by a bug light, you would probably want to see that.
Probably, but not if it was Edward Furlong. I think that's my problem, is this Crow feels like a Crow out of a Crow movie, and everything else feels, I said Alex Cox on purpose, like it feels like Repo Man. It feels like an absurd satire.
I think they're going for that. And I mean, just to show my hand, a lot of Alex Cox movies are sloppy like this.
Yeah, a lot of them are not good.
Did you see Walker? Straight to Hell. He's made Westerns that kind of feel like this.
Yes.
He's a punk rock director, and that sometimes means unprofessional, badly acted, and tonally uneven. And this movie has this in spades.
I was sad to see Yuji Okamoto out of the film so soon. I wanted him to stick around. I kind of found his character sympathetic because he had terminal cancer, as well as one of the more intentionally amusing characters there, that he died by being pushed into a bug light. I looked it up. You can't die by a bug light. It'll hurt you like hell, but the voltage is high and the amps are low. It won't kill you, but it will hurt.
You don't understand that as humor.
No, I didn't.
Okay, think about that. I'm going to have a movie where I'm going to, and seriously, you're going to be shocked that someone dies from touching a bug light. You think that this movie is that?
That's how I was taking it, and it was really bothering me that it tried to sell that as a character death.
I mean, to me, that's a clear signal not to take it seriously.
But then what does this have if it's not going to be serious? I guess you're saying there's laughs to enjoy.
Quirkiness. You use the word laughs as if there are things to make sound expel from your throat.
Well, you keep saying funny.
Yes, quirky. Quirky.
Okay.
The way that I think of Napoleon Dynamite, which is not a laugh out loud movie, but filled with people doing weird things.
I wish this ended with Edward Furlong doing a dance on stage.
Someone's going to do a dance.
I know. Someone is.
There are going to be a dance scene. We're going to get there, and I'm going to laugh. But let's talk about the next death at Ravenfest. Actually, I do not know, how did the fry cook die? How did Famine get it? I know he dies in the scene.
I had to go back and check this twice. What happens is he gets in a baseball bat fight with Edward Furlong.
Mm-hmm.
And Edward Furlong gets him down and then smashes him in the head with the baseball bat. And we see the body fall and twitch. There's no blood.
Huh.
So I don't feel like they really sold that death, because I had the same question later on when Famine isn't around. I'm like, what happened to Famine? So when I was watching it with the commentary, I was paying very close attention. And yes, he is killed at Ravenfest.
Yeah, too fast for me. I didn't track it.
It's not Ravenfest like Birdfest. It's Rave-In-Fest. So this is supposed to be a rave. I don't know if you guys have been to a rave, but this looks like to be about 20 people in a hotel lobby. I don't hear any techno music.
Yeah, very sad.
Not a fest at all.
Yeah, and there's little children there who should not be at a rave.
More to the point, in an earlier scene, War had asked Tara Reid to do her future scenes, and she had the new eyes, and she has this vision of him holding a shotgun against a little boy, and that moment comes to be here. What does it mean? Does Edward Furlong save the boy? It seems like he still gets shot.
No, I think he saves the boy.
No. He pulls him under those covers and saves him.
No, he pulls him under the covers, and the guy shoots the covers, and there's blood all over the covers.
No, he used his magic crow powers to save him. That's the only way I could read it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's how I read it too, is that there were a lot of people killed by war there, and that's the blood under the covers, but there's no little body under the covers.
I just get confused by war because he seems very hesitant and regretful to have to kill all these people. Like, he doesn't want to do it at first. I'm like, your name is War. You are part of a satanic cult. Like, why the hesitancy now?
And this actor is Tank from The Matrix.
No one remembers Tank. He was only in the first one.
I recognized him right away.
Okay, but he was everyone's least favorite character in the first movie. Didn't come back for the sequels. Good on him.
Look, I didn't get excited for seeing Tank.
He was in the best Matrix movie, and so even the worst character in the best Matrix movie is a solid character.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't have a problem with him here. He's what I hear you asking is, why are they not committed to their plan? Because they're not super evil, because they thought they were Satanists until they cut a woman's eyes out. I mean, these people, again, they had to be convinced to eat the peyote-laced deviled eggs. Suddenly they're feeling like, ugh.
They're also on a mission to find a virgin? Like, that line gets dropped earlier, like, okay.
Yeah, who ends up being the person that gets the body.
Who drives the hearse?
Yeah, for reasons I don't know why, Edward Furlong takes a moment to bring his love to a bed so it will be discovered by her brother, who is the sheriff of the reservation. And the sheriff already hated him. So now he's just got even more proof that this Edward Furlong is a killer of his sister. I don't know why he does that. And then later he buries her. After that happens, now he's like, oh good, now I can put her in the ground.
I was so confused because I'm like, I thought he buried her. Why is he bringing the body back now? And then he's burying her.
Yeah. He should have just buried her.
Yeah. This thing was edited with a machete.
Danny Trejo did it?
I also think writing, too. I mean, motivation. When the fact that, like, yeah, they know that they want to have the brother believing something false about our hero. And I think that's a good impulse to have, but you got to set it up correctly. I don't understand why they hate him so much if what he did was defend Lily from, native or not, a man that was raping her. I wouldn't see that as Edward Furlong kills Indians. I would see it as he defends my sister.
Yeah, I agree with that, too.
All I can say is I think there's something about, and this comes through Danny Trejo late in the film, something about this tribe losing their souls because they were selling out to the government and casinos or something. Like, it's caused all this chaos among them. And that's why they're blaming Edward Furlong for stuff. But I don't know. I really don't understand anyone's motivations in this film. I'm just trying to read between very blurry lines.
But it is at the Ravenfest that I get my favorite scene of the movie, which is, you know, damning with faint praise. But after Edward Furlong takes care of Famine, he goes and sits down to chat with Luke and Lola. And Luke and Lola are like, hey, you're resurrected. I'm Satan. Let's join up.
Yeah, I like the nonchalance of that. They're sipping wine and wearing the tacky costumes and all of that and trying to have fun at this very lame rave was a nice way of playing it. Again, a light way of playing it. It's telling you that this is not super evil. This is not a brother and sister having incest and cutting out eyes and eating them because they're so evil. This is just goofballs. And yeah, they also pull the, if you hurt the bird, you hurt the zombie as well, right? Someone throws a tomahawk and it hits the crow. And suddenly Edward Furlong is bleeding. I saw that. They didn't really follow up on it, but I'm pretty sure that happened.
I thought War shot the crow here.
I thought it was a tomahawk.
They attack the crow multiple times in this movie, I think.
Okay. Yeah, whatever. Anyway, they're pulling that old thing, is my point. And Edward Furlong realizes he can be hurt.
This is a basic problem for me, is the rules of this movie. Beyond tone, the fact that here, mid-movie, we see the crow hurt, and Edward Furlong now can be hurt, but yet he's going to keep going and be involved in an explosion and walk away just fine because War is going to lace himself up like a suicide bomber, and Jimmy, Edward Furlong, is going to tackle him so that a bunch of Native Americans aren't killed, and Jimmy is fine to walk away from that even though the crow has been hurt. I'm just lost at basic rules here.
Kind comedy, because the dynamite is dangling between his legs and it looks like a phallus and it's on fire and he's giving a big comedic performance. I mean, you're looking for logic in a movie that's telling you farce. That's what I would direct you towards.
I would say incompetence, but yes.
You keep saying, why doesn't this movie make sense? And it's because the choice was made to make it very quirky and illogical. Some of that is a choice, and some of that is bad writing and bad editing.
Yeah, that's the thing, is I would agree. Some of the things you're citing are choices. This is just bad writing and bad editing. It's not comedic to break your own rules.
But it is comedic to see that guy run out of bullets and go, okay, I guess I'll just blow myself up. I think he is definitely going big, giving us, whether you're laughing or not, I'm going to use the word comedy. And they are at a Catholic church turned bordello.
I just wrote down strip club church.
Yeah, it's got poles and it's got altars and it's got Dennis Hopper with a bunch of honeys all over him sitting on a throne and Macy Gray. Maybe people don't even know who she is anymore, but flash in the pan, one hit wonder, Macy Gray as the madam, I think.
Is that what she is?
You know what? I had to look up who Macy Gray played. I don't recognize Macy Gray other than when she's in, I think, Spider-Man, the 2002 film. I think she's at the parade. But beyond that and her one hit, I didn't recognize her. I saw she played a character named Cara Mia, and I was like, who the hell is Cara Mia? And then when I'm watching the commentary, they're like talking about Macy Gray was great. They were trying to get her to do a song for the soundtrack, but they couldn't afford it. And Dennis Hopper here is my favorite part of the movie. I know I had a favorite scene, my favorite character, El Nino. And on the commentary, they said Dennis Hopper just said, I have no idea what these words mean. Are you telling me an audience will understand when I say these words in this order, what is being said? Because I have no idea what this dialogue means. Can somebody tell me what this dialogue means? I love Dennis Hopper's delivery of every single line he's given.
I mean, Dennis Hopper's just doing Dennis Hopper, and it's great.
I wouldn't even say this is like top shelf Dennis Hopper. This feels like Dennis Hopper not understanding what he's doing.
Yeah.
And probably sober and at the end of his career. Let's face it, he would only be alive for a couple more years. I don't think he looks healthy. When I think about great Dennis Hopper over the top performances, this is not one I'm going to pull out.
I just love that they have given him such cheesy street dialogue to deliver about the OG, and he's supposed to be performing a satanic ritual, but he's speaking, well, he is a pimp, I guess, but he's speaking like a stereotypical pimp the whole time. It is, I thought, unintentional hilarity.
No, it's intentional. Why would it be unintentional?
Yeah, he's doing Dennis Hopper. This is supposed to be funny. This is what he does.
Yeah, again, it seems like, Arnie, you want to say that this movie is incapable of being funny, but it is trying to be funny, and sometimes you are laughing.
I am laughing at Dennis Hopper.
Okay, I think that what he's doing was intended to make you laugh, as is many choices made in this movie, including, like, Boreanaz at the altar, like, almost Nick Caging it up as he's turning into Lucifer. He gets stabbed and then comes back and, you know, is licking his comb as he's adjusting his haircut and all of this. It's just big. I mean, it feels like Jim Carrey or something. I can't miss the difference in tone that this has from any other Crow movie, even if it's following the beats. And appreciate it. Again, I would rather be doing this stuff than having another dark alley where someone is doing badly photographed, badly choreographed karate.
So I think the benefit is this is focusing on the bad guys where that's humor. Because, look, the Crow's going to get crucified in this, which just feels like a very Crow thing to do, to throw him up on a cross. Like, I don't feel like any of that satire quirkiness gets to Edward Furlong's character, unfortunately.
No.
I don't think Edward Furlong is at a great place or a great actor.
Agreed.
To inhabit the comedy. That's what I would say. He was miscast. I agree. He's not very good in this part. But I do believe he's photographed to look like an idiot. And that is what they are trying to do.
No, I agree, because throughout this film, and nothing against the short kings out there, but in a movie, your hero, you build them up to look big. Like, Arnold isn't the giant that you think he is, but they film him that way. And every time I see Edward Furlong fighting, doing action, I'm like, you're 5'6". Like, nothing against being 5'6", but I'm thinking superhero, big, imposing, intimidating. He never looks like that, the way they filmed him.
I agree that Edward Furlong is pathetic in this movie. That is the word I would use. He is just a terrible action hero. And I believe we're supposed to have some excitement in his fights. I think that baseball bat lightsaber fight is supposed to be exciting, and it isn't.
Six String Samurai has a guy that looks very dorky, but has real moves. And they try to walk that line between, oh, he looks like an idiot, and oh, that's really badass. And again, Edward Furlong is wearing suits that don't fit him, that give the impression of a strange body type. And yes, the muss of his hair and the shortness and all of that is contributing to the idea that he is in, again, what I was asking for. He is in no way a clone of Brandon Lee. He is doing something else, and good on them for taking a risk.
He's doing an awful job and you're praising it because it's different?
Yes.
Yeah, I can go and put $5,000 on red at a casino and that's taking a risk, but that doesn't mean it's a good idea.
I wouldn't have cast him in this role. And if I did, I would have probably cast him as the villain. I would have probably cast him as the wannabe Lucifer that didn't get the girl. I mean, he still looks like a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the weird thing, is he doesn't look like he grew into adulthood. And just switch him with Boreanaz. I think you've solved half the problem.
But I think Boreanaz can kick Edward Furlong's ass, and so that wouldn't be a fair matchup. I wouldn't find Edward Furlong to be an intimidating nemesis.
But that is the Crow formula, to be hopelessly overmatched. If you were going to follow it seriously, you would obviously make Boreanaz be the Crow. But they've chosen the unlikely to be the star because I presume, I can only surmise, they thought it would make the film more original, quirky, funny, etc.
Now that you've said Hobbit, Jacob, I cannot not see Edward Furlong as Elijah Woods meets Robert Smith.
Yeah, and it's as absurd as you speak. What are they rushing off to do? Tara Reid, they're trying to make the Antichrist, and she needs to have the impregnation before sunrise. I think that's what I hear.
They have to, like, kill a virgin, they kill that hearse driver, and then they have to fuck so she could get the Antichrist put in her?
Correct.
Do they have to fuck on a totem pole?
No, I think they could have fucked anywhere.
Just before sunrise.
Yeah.
They go to a cemetery, but it looks like a totem pole they're on, not a gravestone or something.
And this is where we have the change of art. We haven't mentioned Danny Trejo too much, but he's been scowling this whole time. He's a religious figure. I think he's a Catholic priest, which makes me beg how he wound up with a daughter at all.
No, he's a shaman.
But he's wearing a collar.
Yeah, he's talking about Easter on the radio and Catholic Mass, and you better be at church. So I'm not sure, Arnie, that this is some kind of nativist religion.
Well, he's definitely going to be doing some kind of stereotypical dance.
I think that's them getting back to their roots that they have denied with the mine and the casino. Like, this is that big cultural moment where they embrace who they are and get back to their traditions. And this is supposed to move you. This, I guess it's not a chicken dance, it's a crow dance.
No, no, no. This is not supposed to be serious. What I want to know is how much tequila was involved in the filming of this scene to get Trejo to do this, because it is hysterical.
Oh, my God.
On one hand, I could see Trejo just wanting to do it. Like, hey, take your shirt off and do a chicken dance. And he's like, yep, let's do it.
Why not? Mm-hmm.
When I watched this the first time, I didn't understand why such a Hispanic man was doing a Native American ritual. And it wasn't until listening to the commentary where they're like, oh no, there were Mexican Native Americans. Do I understand this was all intentional?
Yeah, no, I understand that. But when he's like throwing out Spanish, again, it was confusing me.
Oh, very confusing.
And do you believe them? I'm not believing that commentary. They wanted to have Danny Trejo because Danny Trejo's fun.
He was a Mexican Jew in Death Race.
They don't really care in 2005 whether that is culturally correct to change the ethnicity that way. That's not what this movie's trying to do, because this movie is not trying to be representational. It is trying to be outrageous and succeeding sometimes. I'm just going to say.
But Danny Trejo's dance is able to bring the crow back to life, and that gives Jimmy all his powers back for a very perfunctory final battle with Satan.
Again, I don't think Edward Furlong is up for fights. In the few scenes that he's had, it feels like a stunt guy flipping. This matchup just wouldn't be convincing. If you actually had these two fight in any kind of arena, it just wouldn't work. I think he just ends up kicking the guy down the hill and sticking him on a tombstone.
Yes, they said that's an homage to Top Dollar from the first film, the way Top Dollar got impaled on that church spire that they wanted David Boreanaz impaled on a tombstone there.
But they don't kill Bai Ling, or in this case, Tara Reid. They let the mystic woman, she actually is praying to God by the end. She switches teams, I think. She's sitting there and the sun comes up and all of a sudden she starts quoting Bible scripture.
Is she blind? Her eyes start to bleed. They did film a scene where Jimmy went and took the eyes back and they turned to dust, but apparently they couldn't afford the effects to finish that scene. And so it's just left with her eyes bleeding and she puts on some, like, I just had a cornea transplant sunglasses.
Yeah, I took it as she was blind. We'll see Lily has her eyes back in the afterlife or whatever that is. So I assume she's blind. I mean, that seems like the punishment you get. You steal someone's eyes, now you go blind.
Yeah.
She just doesn't act blind when she's getting handcuffed and things.
Who acts in this film at all?
Yeah, Terry doesn't act. That's not what she's here for. But she doesn't get shot. The point is Trejo wanted to take her out. He's fully exonerated the Crow. Jimmy, he no longer holds it against him, whatever befell his people, you know, they have a common enemy. And so he wants to whack Tara Reid, and the sheriff's son intervenes and arrests her.
And Jimmy goes off to a swing set and Lily in the afterlife, because that's how all these Crow films end.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Goofy. I mean, this end song, again, it'd be one thing if they had hard-thumping industrial, but this, some people like to be on key, but that's a choice, according to whoever this singer is. That's just a choice that you can make if you want to. To me, it's just goofy that we have this Alive in Your Memories song playing over this. It mocks what used to be played straight.
And the singer was playing it completely straight. There's a whole featurette about the composer. And of course, they couldn't afford to buy this song or anything. So this is the composer with a singer.
I think it's his sister, right? They have the same last name.
It may have been. I didn't catch that.
Yeah, I noticed all the music was published by Wicked Prayers, like Limited or something. Like, yeah, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no soundtrack to this one. There's not a single licensed song.
Nope.
There's just this, like you say, off-key thing that the director's like, this needs some top 40 airplay. I'm like, this needs to be turned off quickly.
They had auto-tune back then.
Yeah. No. Again, it wouldn't make sense. They haven't had that kind of Crow to play those kinds of songs. You wouldn't accept Portishead or, you know, Hole or anything. No, no. That's not what you made. You made the off-key folk song. That's what they made this time.
But did they make something that's going to get a recommend? Well, I think we've all already said no, but...
Hell no.
But hey, Jacob, Stuart, what are your final thoughts on the Crow Wicked Prayer? Jacob.
This is a movie where motivations are literally spelled out on the screen, and I still don't know what the motivations are or can follow this film, track it. Like, why is stuff going on? I thought this was about raising the Antichrist, but we're eating deviled eggs. And yes, is there some quirkiness or some humor in there? I mean, like, yeah, that's why you got Dennis Hopper showing up. I assume that's why you have Danny Trejo taking off his shirt to do that dance. Like, there is stuff that I'm laughing at, but it is so uneven. And yeah, films like Repo Man or Walker, like, I love those films, but other Alex Cox films, like you said, Straight from Hell, oh, that was real hard to get through. And he did a follow-up to Repo Man called Repo Chick, which is one of the worst things I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
So quirkiness alone will not get me through a film. Like, there has to be something more. And this, there is no more, because what's left is Edward Furlong, who is the worst Crow, from makeup to his look to just, yeah, this feels like a fan film. Go on YouTube and you could probably find better Crow fan films than this, actually. But this is real low quality. Maybe you could find some fun in Devil's Food Cake in those kind of jokes. Dennis Hopper trying to talk street lingo. Yeah, real low quality here. No reason to see this one. Strong, strong, not recommend. It is wicked.
Stuart.
And look. I don't love this movie, but I did have a prayer and it was answered. I was tired of watching the same movie get worse and worse. And what I saw was a concerted effort to do something radically different in tone, if not in plotting. And no, the plotting is still very bad and follows many of the same tropes, But what I appreciate is that it has goofy indie spirit that made me smile from time to time. I will just say the reason why I think this is the best Crow movie.
The best.
Yes, for easily. Easily. Again, I will say it one more time. I hate these movies. I hate The Crow, and it got worse and worse.
No, that is saying something, how much you hate it, if this is the best.
So now I merely don't like something, and it's the best. So that is what I can say. My prayer has been answered, and now do I dare wish for a movie that's good? No. But better? Please, God, please.
And I think that this movie should be taken, hanged, have what little heart it has in it cut out, and then never resurrected.
Buried in a refrigerator?
Yes, seriously. This movie is the worst thing with the Crow name on it, and that includes the TV series that people hate, and the book this was based on, which was not good.
Is it worse than the broken video game?
Yes, I do believe it is worse than the broken video game. Although I still haven't played it. I just watched the walkthrough. I would rather watch that walkthrough again than watch this movie for a fourth time. David Boreanaz does not differentiate his performance enough when he's Satan or when he's just Luke. As Jacob said, Edward Furlong is the weakest Crow. Just a terrible, terrible performance and a silly look that may be intentional. I mean, he is putting on his makeup with a Sharpie. Maybe I am supposed to laugh, but I'm not laughing, I'm groaning. And the only redeemable thing is Dennis Hopper not knowing what he's saying, but saying street lingo. That's worth a YouTube, if it's out on YouTube. But the rest of this movie is utter shit, and I can see why it killed the franchise entirely. I can see why this is the death of The Crow. Of course, it may have taken almost 20 years, but The Crow brought this franchise back from the dead coming in August, but this was a nail in the coffin in my mind. I don't want any more Crow after this.
Well, I would say this. If you were ever a fan of anything that had come before, this is an utter betrayal. This pisses on what you must have loved because its instincts are to do the opposite. It laughs when the other one drew tears on. The other one tried to kick ass and this one farts. You know, that is the difference. Yes, I guess if you switched out, made Scream 4 a scary movie, that would piss me off. I wouldn't want to watch that. That would be my least favorite Scream movie. But if you're open to a bad movie, series at least laughing at itself. Again, I would say best of the lot. Can the premise be worked well? I don't think any of us have said great, right? Am I correct in saying that? They have not made a great Crow film?
They have not.
No.
Okay.
And I think I like the first one most of all of us.
They made half of a good one.
Okay. Half of a good one that both of you recommended. And then nobody else has been enjoying anything, right?
No.
It's all been a shit sandwich.
But they continually get worse.
And now, will it be the worst of all? There's no way, right? It's got to be just the production values alone.
Stuart, he has tattoos, which means it's betrayed everything in the comics. It is the worst one. It's already been declared.
Oh, are fans mad?
Yes.
Because he doesn't look like Brandon Lee?
Because get off my lawn. You can't update the look of the Crow.
Because he looks 2024 and not 1994.
You must update the look of him. If he looked like Brandon Lee, I would be so mad. I wouldn't go. I would actually protest and not see the film. They are going to make something different. And it was supposed to come out this week, but they kicked the can to late August because that's when all the good movies come. And we will have that debate 2 months from now. In the meantime, let's get on to some platinum. I've actually been really looking forward to diving back into Ty West's crazy trilogy that started not that long ago. X was 2022.
Yep. If you are a platinum level donor or patron, you will be joining us next week as we start our review of the X trilogy with that 2022 film X. Hopefully you are joining us. But if not, thank you for your support at whatever level you chose to support us. We appreciate it. Every single dollar helps keep this show going. Thank you so much from all of us, from our hearts that have not been cut out by David Boreanaz. We appreciate you for supporting us and for listening to Now Playing. And we will be back next week with a review of X because we can't podcast all the time.
You know, my daddy used to say, every man's got a devil, and you can't rest till you find him.
Thank you for your support of Now Playing.
And don't tell me you owe me one.
I owe you one.
Your support helps keep Now Playing on the air.
And once in my life, I wasn't alone.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Ngonza Media Incorporated.
I don't believe it.
Truth is, belief's not required.
Ngonza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
Goddamn creatures in the night, they never learn.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
I shouldn't have seen any of them.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Ngonza Media Incorporated.
I'm going to kill them. Every single one of them.
Now Playing is a Ngonza Media production, copyright 2024, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Ngonza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Buildings burn. People die. But real love is forever.
Today we're discussing The Crow, Wicked Prayer. I can't decide if they mean like evil prayer or if that's a wicked good prayer.
No one talks like that.
Or wicked as in bad, like this film?
Yeah, it's evil.
No, my cousins do talk like that. That's wicked awesome.
Yeah, no one in this movie talks like that, is what I was saying.
No, that's a shame.
Yeah.